There is this thing. Do you realize what is? There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing. Do you realize what is? There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing.
On.
There is this thing going on.
What?
Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called?
The news brought to you live.
Everybody, it is Tuesday, March 19th, and it's just past 5 p.m. You are listening to the Local Journalism Initiative Roundup here on CKUT. I'm your host, Jules, and we are doing this show with the support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada, and today is a very special show because we are doing it during CKUT's funding drive. It's a week every year where we ask our listeners to help support the station through donations. It's an amazing way to come and support all your favorite programmers. So that's the news team, it's me and all our news collective volunteers growing every single week at the station. It's the spoken word department, arts and culture. It's all our music volunteers, people who are bringing you the shows you love every hour of every day, every week. So right now, unfortunately, our website donations page is down. But if you go to cqt.ca/donate, you can see all the amazing CKUT swag that you will be able to get when you do donate. That should be fixed by tomorrow. But please keep CKUT in your minds and in your hearts. Today, we've got a packed show for you, starting off with a live in-studio interview about a new committee by the Quebec government. Last fall, there were protests in Quebec, as in the rest of Canada, against queer and trans-inclusive education. And they've borne fruit here in Quebec through a new Comité des Sages. So there was the September 20th so-called Million March for Children, where groups asked for topics of gender and sexuality to be kept out of schools. And now there's this new government committee of, quote, wise men, as it's being called in French, which is consulting with community groups and will advise the government on policies towards trans and non-binary people. The question is, how far will the CAC government go to placate the growing parents' rights movement? And will it come at the expense of trans children? Launched just yesterday, the Nous ne serons pas sages coalition brings together over 100 organizations, activists, and researchers to call for the dissolution of the Comité des Sages. Joining me now is coalition spokesperson Zael Gourde. Zael, thanks so much for joining me.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So, I just want to get started with understanding this Comité des Sages. What are the issues that are here with this new government committee? Why did your group launch this campaign yesterday?
Basically, the very existence of the committee is something we oppose. It it is built on the notion there is an issue with trans people, our existence, our presence, and the fact that we're being discussed in medias and television. Beyond just gender education in school, what the Million March organizers and all of the other far-right protests we've seen are, they're really calling for the disappearance of trans people in public life. And by simply creating this committee, Legault is giving weight to their demands. He said basically that they are reasonable concerns that need to be heard. And for us, that's very insulting because those people come from far-right extremist religious groups. They are, we like, on the ground, because we were, many of us were on the ground during those protests. And what people are reporting said that those people were calling slurs, were violent, they attacked people. Those are not reasonable people. They're members of the organized religious far right. And it's surprising for a government that has played themselves as like the good governance type to play on those fears. And beyond that, the committee is in no way legitimate to decide or recommend anything concerning trans people. There's no trans people involved in the committee, and there isn't even someone that has like experience working with trans youth or trans people in general. They're all fully inapt in this mission, and two of the committee members have expressed ideas that are like marked by transphobia and or have ties with organized transphobic groups.
Yeah, and you know, when you say that François Legault is appealing to far-right actors and, you know, intense religious groups, what exactly are their demands? Like, what would they like to see in terms of, you know, inclusive education around gender and sexual orientation, gender identity, things like that? What are they pushing for that the CAC government is sort of like considering or giving credence to by putting this committee forward?
It depends. The people that organized the protest last fall were a broad coalition of right-wing and mainly far-right groups. And they didn't came out with like a very clear, like, are we on those policies? Basically, depending who's talking to them and the context, they're always moving the goalpost. Anything that is inclusive of trans people, they have a problem with, especially when it comes to young people. They are opposed to education that just explains the fact that trans people exist. That's, even this is, for many of them, is too much. Just saying trans people exist in a school context. They one of the big thing too is they want the same kind of legislation we've seen in Alberta and New Brunswick and Saskatchewan that force the outing of trans youth to their parents, and which is very dangerous. One of the main perpetrators of violence against trans youths are their own families. In many contexts, families are not a safe environment for trans youth. Like, trans youth are overrepresented in the trans homeless population, and the main reason is because they're being pushed on the street by their own parents because they are trans, and it's also true for other queer folks. They're pushing against the drag story hours. They're pushing against access to trans medical care, which is proven to be life-saving. And beyond that, they are inviting violence against trans people, especially when there isn't as much cameras around, or like the groups we've seen in the streets are not simply like concerned actors, they're hate groups. And Legault is kind of playing balls without not fully endorsing them, but saying that their concerns need to be listened to. But by the composition of the committee and the way it was framed, it's clear that he's not setting it up to be something that's going to condemn those concerns.
Yeah, I'm going to jump in there because I think it's important to really talk about the Comité des Sages, the sort of wise men committee, and who are the sort of so-called wise men who the government has chosen here. Because, you know, that's been a large part of the opposition from groups like yours, is just that the people who are leading the committee don't have expertise with the community, the trans community. You know, is that sort of all there is to it, just that these people are not experienced, or is there more to the story here?
There's a lot more here. The president of the committee is someone called Diane Lavallée. And Diane Lavallée has been, it's been found that she has like a deep, she had a deep personal friendship with Diane Guibeau, which is now dead but used to be the president of Pour le droit des femmes du Québec, PDF Québec, which is a TERF group.
Sorry, could you explain TERF?
Oh, sorry, it's a trans radical exclusive feminist group. Basically, it's a group that revendicates, like, that claims itself to be feminist, but who oppose the inclusion of trans people within feminism. They're also Islamophobic, and they oppose the rights of sex workers. And they split from the Fédération des Femmes du Québec, the Women's Federation of Québec, basically because they thought it was too progressive, too inclusive of Muslims and trans people and sex workers. And Diane Lavallée had a friendship with Diane Guibeau, who used to be the president of PDF Québec. And she also published a video on the website of PDF Québec giving homage to that director. And in this video, she defended and she praised the fact that Diane Guibeau fought against the dangerous ideas of intersectionality. Which she said we needed to raise a red flag against. And that Diane Guibeau basically opposed the fact that a trans woman was elected president of the One Federation. She called out what she called, like, the trans lobby from taking over taking over feminist space. And so her ties, the ties of Diane Lavallée, it's a bit confusing. There's two Diane there, but basically Diane Lavallée is the president of the Wise Men Council, and her ties with PDF Québec are very worrying. PDF Québec is not like a real, like, woman advocacy group. They mainly led, like, misinformation campaign online. They created fake scandals framing trans activists as pedophile for talking about gender euphoria. They said that gender euphoria was a fetish, a sexual fetish, and that talking about gender euphoria to children amounted to a sex crime against children. While gender euphoria just is the term to use when someone feels good in their gender expression. So it's, like, fully misleading, and it's a fear campaign. And so the ties, having someone on the council with ties to PDF Québec is more than worrying. It's revealing of the agenda from Legault, which has maintained close ties with PDF Québec because they were the only woman group to back the Bill 21 when it was passed. And so PDF Québec has really close ties with the CAQ government. And another member of the committee, not good remembering name, Patrick Taillon, has expressed itself on Radio-Canada and Cob Radio about the fact that schools should be outing trans kids to their parents, that schools don't have a right to keep that information away from their parents, basically playing on what has been called parental rights, the rights of parents, which, for anyone listening that isn't aware, it's not a real thing in any form of legal context. Parents don't have a right as parents, but children have a right in many national, provincial, and international documents. Parental rights were invented by the far-right evangelical preachers in the U.S. to oppose, basically, the end of segregation in school and to oppose progressive education. And it's being imported in Quebec right now through this notion of, like, parents have a right to prevent their kid from being exposed to diversity and to prevent their kid from being trans, basically. From parents should, like, agree to the school respecting their kid's pronouns. That's one of the things he also said, that parents should have, like, their say in this matter.
Yeah, so, I mean, there's a lot in there, but it sounds like what you're saying is that, you know, there's this uniquely, I guess, Quebecois network, right? Where the PDF is this group that came to political prominence within the CAQ for their support of Bill 21, their opposition to wearing the hijab in this very, like, secularist kind of brand of feminism. And because of that link, you know, they're now being really included in this committee, but you're also bringing up this larger context in which terms like parents' rights, you know, started in the United States, migrated here. Even the protest that we saw, the 1 Million March for Children, which was called anti-SOGI, right? It was like, yeah. SOGI stands, I think, for sexual orientation, gender identity. It's a type of curriculum you can have in schools. But those protests happened. Exactly. They happened here, but the actual curriculum didn't exist in Quebec. So we have on the one hand something that's uniquely Quebecois, and on the other hand something that is completely imported from an outside context. And I'm curious to hear from you about, you know, what are the sort of elements that might make what's happening here different from what's happening in other contexts? Is there anything about the story in this Comité des Sages that, you know, is something distinct from what we're seeing in other contexts?
There's a few different things. One of the things that's important to realize is that Quebec has been for years a, not necessarily a bastion, but a strong place for trans movement and trans-related issue. Like, statistically, many studies have shown that, like, Francophones are one of the main groups when polled in Canada that would say that they would support their kid coming out as trans. And Quebec has, for a long time, had amongst the most progressive law regarding to trans issues. And so there isn't the same popular support, or at least there wasn't the same popular support for transphobic things. And so that's one of the reasons I think Legault cannot just put a bill right now that would be transphobic. He tried, basically, he already tried with Bill 2 two years ago, basically, a bit more than 2 years ago, which was theorized to be probably something that was proposed by PDF Quebec, because they were the only group that came out in support of the bill, even amongst the right wing here. And so there's something very Quebecois about the first going through a wise man council. It's the same thing they did with Bill 21. It's basically trying to give legitimacy, trying to build support for those issues, give them a sense of credibility by creating basically an expert council of ideologues. And so that's very Quebecois. That's a really CAC thing to go to do, like building the ground before you can like really make a political push in that direction. But otherwise, I think it's really an import of things that were happening outside of Quebec. It's not innate, like a native is maybe not the right word, but like it's not a locally grown movement. It's really coming from the Anglo-Saxon world, meaning England and the like southern United States. And amongst our coalition, there's a bunch of anti-fascist groups like Montreal Anti-Fascist or Pink Bloc or others that weren't really involved during the counter-protests against this. And they also infiltrated, but they found ways to have access to information from within those groups. And we know that it was never again about Soji. Like, it's one of the clear things. It's when they name specific policies or stuff like that, it's never really about this. It's always about just a larger moral panic that's been created by the media, a larger demonization of trans people. And if you go for any like trans-related post online, you will see all those people creeping out, calling trans and queer people pedophiles, saying they should be killed. It's really the discourse we're walking with. It's a fascistic-leaning movement. And so this is really not something that came out of Quebec. The Quebec far right has been mainly dead for many years, since 2016, 2017. But Legault is really giving wind to the sail of a new kind of far right that is that resemble less what we're usually used to hear, and more what's coming from the prairies or the southern states or England.
Yeah, and you know what's curious, or I guess what remains to be seen, is just how will this succeed? Because in other aspects, right, the CAC project has been very successful, like, you know, recent polling notwithstanding. If you traditionally have polled François Legault across the rest of Canada's premiers, he has done very, very well. And you know, even like, you're talking about the importing of this culture war, or I think you used the term moral panic, into Quebec. And, you know, we just saw the unanimous adoption of a motion in Quebec's National Assembly criticizing Canada's Supreme Court for using the expression person with a vagina in a judgment on the grounds that this language, you know, invisibilized women. So that was like, you know, we subsequently found that was used one time out of over 60 uses of the word women. But, you know, clearly a sort of op-ed from the National Post decrying this is enough to now have this written into like our National Assembly, our place of political like judgments. And my question to you is just, you know, if Quebec is starting at a baseline of respect and support for trans rights, but we are seeing these kinds of, you know, these kinds of rhetorics or these kinds of movements gaining ground, what are the next steps for supporters and defenders and allies of trans rights and trans people? Like, apart from just, I guess, supporting your coalition, what can people do to get involved?
One thing is we should see it for what it is. It's a moral panic being built through the media and through far-right groups. And we should see that it's something that is built like on a constant repetition, basically, of saying it enough and enough until it becomes serious. And in that sense, we need to oppose this discourse everywhere we see it. We shouldn't give it any sort of legitimacy or not treat it as something that's reasonable. We should oppose it systematically. But other than that, I think it's really important to support a trans-led initiative. I think a lot of why the far right is picking on trans people to build like that moral panic is that there's not that many of us. We're a really small percentage of the population. And so we really need people of good conscience to walk with us on the 31st during our protest, but in general to be there when there's a protest that needs to be opposed, but also like to organize event or activities or invite trans people to come speak to in your school, in your union, in your women's group. And we're seeing like a lot of the progressive parts of society, including most of Quebec's feminist group, really coming to this position and realizing that there's a need to like actively get involved. But other than that, like, I think Quebec is less transphobic than it is racist. And I think we're not going to see the same kind of mass participation to this kind of initiative from the government as we saw from for Bill 21. But this, to be said, like, Radio-Canada published a, like, really transphobic and misinformed, poorly sourced episode of their show Enquête about like trans youth access to healthcare, where they basically gave like a lot of time to Lisa Littman, which is a discredited pseudo-scientific transphobe that had a lot of her research taken out of academic paper, lost a lot of her academic credibility, but Radio-Canada like still gave her hair time and basically built a whole episode like in one of their most popular show along her like thinking. And I think a lot of people in position of power, in position of like inside medias, inside institution, really need to think carefully about what they're doing, because they're enabling the violent far right. And even the CSIS said that there's a serious risk for extreme violence coming from transphobic groups. And so like people are playing a dangerous game, trying to make like basically to gain political capital or gain like viewers numbers through playing on that moral panic. And I think there wasn't any politician in the National Assembly that had the courage to like call out this motion for what it is, the motion that you talked about, for what it is, which is like a pure product of moral panic. And I think people should think about their place in history right now, because we're seeing right-wing, far-right politicians, movement gain a lot of power through this. And we've seen what those kind of things can do in the past. It's not the first time, first moral panic in history. It's not the first one that has been linked with a violent extremist group. And we know what it leads to in history. And I think people should, I don't think people really want to be on the side of the rise of fascism. And I don't think people are going to, this ideology leads to the death of trans people, like we've seen with Next Benedict, like we've seen with Brianna Gay. And I think people should think about that and should really think about where they want to be in their storybook around this whole period.
Yeah, just to wrap up, I know you talked about there's a march coming up on March 31st.
Yeah.
Can you give more information for those who are looking to join in? What's that all about and how can people get involved here in Montreal?
Yeah, so every year, March 31st is the Trans Day of Visibility and Trans Day of Vengeance. The two names are used by the community. And so in honor of this day and to call for the dissolution of the committee and more widely to oppose transphobia, we are calling at 2 p.m. On the 31st of March at the 600 Fulham Street for a big protest. we wanted to be really a moment of coming together and exposing like the scale of our collective power, our solidarity, and our anger toward the like legitimization of transphobia from the government. And it's not a coincidental spot. That's where the Minister of Family has its office.
And Ministry of Education too.
Yeah, the Ministry of Education too. But the Family Minister is the one the Wiseman Council is dependent from, which in itself is really weird because I don't know why it's a family issue, trans stuff. But it's also where on the 31st of March, there was probably the biggest counter-protest in their history of Quebec to oppose the far right, or at least the contemporary history. And it was when the second Million March was supposed to happen, but unions, women groups, student association, and queer militant groups, LGBT association, all came together and had more than 1,000 people facing a few hundred transphobes, and basically blocked them from protesting in any capacity. And so it's really a space that has a recent history of our community and our allies and other groups coming together. And it's also like significant because of what I said, like it's the offices. So I really hope people are going to come through. We're trying to make it fun. It's going to be a more positive protest than the counter protest. We're walking on our own basis. There's going to be, we're like trying to get buses from Sherbrooke and Quebec for people from outside of the city to come in. And we're going to try to have fun activities afterward.
Yeah, great. All right. Well, that's going to be March 31st. And I'm sure that you will be, anyone who's interested will be hearing about it probably more on CKUT as well. But Zael, thank you so much for coming and chatting with me.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right. So our next story is about housing. Less than a month ahead of the federal budget, more than 200 people took advantage of the presence of the Minister of Housing, Infrastructure and Communities, Sean Fraser, at the Canada Mortgage and Housing Corporation's National Housing Conference, also known as CMHC Conference. They bust into Ottawa yesterday with a simple goal, to call on the Trudeau government to reinvest in social housing. I spoke with Catherine Lussier of the Front d'Action Populaire en Réaménagement Urbain, also known as FRAPRU, which is a Quebec-based coalition for social housing, about what needs to change in Canada's national housing strategy. Take a listen.
So I'm Catherine Lussier, and I'm the coordinator of FRAPRU.
Yeah, and you just got back from Ottawa, where FRAPRU and other groups were rallying for social housing today. Can you tell me about that event?
So today we went to Ottawa because the Canadian Mortgage Housing Corporation was actually holding a conference, the National Housing Conference today, and the Minister of Housing was speaking this morning. And the goal of that conference is to try to find solution to keep or re-get affordability over Canada and also to build faster. Obviously for us, the solution are known since a lot of time. I mean, we keep repeating it, and the importance of social housing, the importance of financing adequately social housing. So we were there to repeat that message, saying that we know the solution and we want this national strategy to illustrate this the solution.
Yeah, just I want to take a step back because, you know, we talk about the housing crisis all the time. But, you know, just to give people an idea, a concrete idea, you know, how big is the deficit of affordable housing that we're facing in Quebec? What is the scope of the problem?
So only in Quebec, we have at least 345,000 people, I mean, household that are actually paying too much for their rent. I mean, your rent should not be more than 30% of your income. So these 345,000 people household in Quebec are actually paying too much for their housing. So obviously they have to cut somewhere.
The government, through the CMHC, their big strategy is this national housing strategy. And, you know, I've heard groups like yours critique the approach that the government has been taking in response to the housing crisis. And I'd like to hear more from you about what are the main mechanisms that that strategy is promoting, how it's going about increasing access to housing in Canada, and what you would like to see the focus on instead?
So it's already have been 5 years that the national strategy have been put in place. The main goal was to reduce the homelessness and also to reduce the amount of people that were struggling to pay the rent or were have, you know, were living in the condition that was unacceptable. The strategy was supposed to target low and moderate income household, which we actually see right now that it didn't do that over the last 5 years. It even contributed to the increase in the speculation or in the rent because it has financed housing that is actually unaffordable, housing that will be $2,000 a month, and that obviously is not at all targeting people at low income. No one is going to afford $2,000 a month. So it has contributed that way that they continue financing housing that is inadequate, that is too expensive. And also this housing bring up the price over, you know, upper and upper and upper. So it has played a role on this housing crisis when we see how much the rent have increased in a few years. It's not obviously the only thing, but it has contributed to it. And that's why we are saying to the federal government that if we want to answer to the low and moderate income tenants that are unable to house themselves in Canada, we need social housing. We need housing that is out of the market because the market itself is never going to answer those needs.
Even when the funding does exist, like for instance, last fall, there was the joint $1.8 billion investment from Canada and Quebec. And even, you know, there's pockets of money within the housing strategy itself. You know, these programs are designed to incentivize affordable housing rather than social housing. What's the difference there? And why does it, you know, why does it matter? Because more and more, it seems like governments are talking about affordable housing, but groups like the FREPRU housing committees, the RECLAC, have sort of raised the alarm, at least here in Quebec, about the shift in language from social to affordable housing. And I want to understand, you know, why that matters.
It matters because when we're speaking about affordable housing, there is no unique definition of affordable housing. So what is affordable for one person is not affordable for the other one. And when you look through the programs, most of the programs, depending on which government and which program, will have a different definition of what is affordable. So, for example, in the fund, the co-investment fund that has now changed the name, and I think it's the Fund for Affordable Housing, the price of the apartment is actually calculated over the 30% of the income of the household living in a zone. Independently, they are a landlord. Independently, they are tenants. Independently, they win like $200,000 a year, or they just win $11,000 a year. And all over Canada, these apartments that have been built were over $2,000 a month. And that's why we say if we want to make the solution, and we need to not forget that this is social housing. Social housing is out of the market. You will have a bit more control. You have the much democratic for tenants life inside of a social housing that you will not find at in the market, obviously. So for us, the vocabulary is important because when the government is speaking about we're going to build affordable housing, then what are they talking about? Because in any way, we know exactly the intention until they create the programs. And then in the programs, you realize that the definition is not going to work. And then they target like other type of like tenants that maybe are not the one that we should build housing for. And that's why for us, if we meant truly to develop social housing, we need to, you know, force the vocabulary to be social housing, because we know what we're speaking, and that's the solution if we want to truly house the low-income tenants, the moderate-income tenants, If not, we are going to keep, you know, closing the eyes over what's the real issue here. And also affordable could mean private sector's development also that is supported by federal government.
You know, the Quebec budget was released last week, and I know that this is slightly off topic for a discussion of federal housing, but, you know, people were also criticizing the Quebec government about a lack of investment in housing during a housing crisis. And here we've seen the province shift from, you know, a social housing fund, Axelogie, towards the FAC, which is a program that is incentivizing both social and affordable housing that is designed to be more easily used by private developers. You know, what is that sort of, I guess, lack of investment at the provincial level in social housing, this shift away from social housing as a priority? Yeah, I guess how big of a problem are we creating here in Quebec if, as you say, the federal government is not investing in social housing and hasn't in any major way since the 1990s?
We're talking about the Quebec government, but it makes a difference because all over Canada, Quebec was the only one to still have a program that was dedicated for developing social housing. It's hundreds of units that have been built after the federal government actually retreated himself from financing social housing. Just to give an idea of what a government can do is like from 1971 to 1991, the part of social housing passed from 0.5% to 9.5% on the rental apartment in Quebec. It's like 9% in few and in 20 years that we have been able to offer up. So it has a massive impact that the government is refusing to invest, especially in a housing crisis, because it's hundreds of projects that are not probably going to even be able to get out of the ground. In Montreal, we know that there's still at least 5 projects that are in danger of not having sufficient funding. And that's, you know, another hundreds of like apartments that will not be offered for families, for elderlies that aren't, just because we are refusing to put sufficient funding to massively and quickly develop the social housing we need to house correctly people.
You know, the government of Montreal recently announced changes or updates to their bylaw called Règlement pour un métropole mixte, the bylaw that was encouraging, or I guess, you know, mandating that some kind of social or affordable housing was added into new private housing projects above a certain size. Obviously, that made headlines last year when the opposition party told reporters that no housing projects had successfully had this kind of housing added as a result of the bylaw. The city said there were a few, but basically it was deemed to be a failure, and they've since put out a little bit of a tweak. Obviously, we're seeing the federal and provincial governments not step up in terms of social housing. Is this a kind of initiative that municipalities can take on to put some muscle in the lack of funding from these other levels of government?
It's a pretty good question. On our side, we consider that these bylaws, or this bylaw that also was well known under the 20-20-20 for 20% of social housing, 20 of affordable and 20 for family housing, are necessary. Because the question is always, what are we developing and for who we are developing? And we're all considering that municipality should force that at least there is 20% of social housing in those developments, for assuring at least that some of the tenants that are going to get affected by those developments will have a place to stay and will be able to stay in their neighborhood. But even though we consider that it is essential for us, unfortunately, what has presented or is going to present the city of Montreal and going to adopt today or tomorrow morning, it's not going enough far enough for us. In this context, we consider that promoters should not have the choice between developing a project on site or making a financial contribution. For us, at the moment that the promoter has space on his project to build a social housing project, he should not have the choice of building social housing project.
I'd like to close with a larger question about the role of social housing, because I think a lot of this conversation, you know, where we've talked about how you'd like to see different levels of government do more, you know, a lot of the reason why they don't do more is because a lot of people in government and in just like civil society in general, right, people see the role of government in terms of housing to be facilitating private development, to be providing maybe a little bit of funding here or there, but generally just giving the private sector or community groups, you know, NGOs, the tools that they need to succeed. And this whole mentality of building and providing and, you know, administering, upkeeping social housing from the government is just kind of passé. As you said, in Quebec, we were the only place to have a real social housing fund in Canada. And so it sounds like that whole mentality will need to change to get to where groups like the FRAPRU want to get to. What is your, I guess, case to be made for that? I know the protest was at the CMHC conference where Sean Fraser was speaking. You know, if you were sitting with Sean Fraser, what would you say to him?
We have to see housing as a right and not as a way to make money. And this is a fundamental way of seeing social housing. It's housing out of the market. It's either belong to a co-op, it's either belong to the public government, you know, it's public, so it belongs to the government, or it belongs to a nonprofit organization. The goal itself of the house, of these apartments, are not to make profit or to house people. And as long as we're going to see housing as a way to make money, there is going to be people that will suffer from it. And it is essential, because when you look at low-income people, people that are discriminated, and we can name them, like right now, like that you have kids and you're discriminated, you don't have salary enough, you're discriminated, you had like a bad luck and don't have a good credit, you're discriminated. Social housing should not discriminate you based on that. That's also why they're necessary, is like at the moment you offer a good place to stay, a decent place to stay, people can get more involved. Children could have more stability and learn more. We know the consequences also on having bad housing situation on health, that is mental or even physical health. Social housing is necessary because we should see housing as a right. And that's why we are asking. And that's what's supposed to be the strategy at the beginning. It was supposed, we even, you know, a vote, a law that was to recognize the right to housing. At the same time, we adopted that national strategy. And for us, unfortunately, we haven't seen a real voluntary from the government to truly put housing as a right in our society and then put the investment that comes with it. As much as health, as much as education, as much as many other and other rights that we have, we haven't seen any government to put what it needs to truly, you know, respect that right and stop seeing it as a merchandise, as something we can just exchange on a market and make a lot of profit over it. And that's what needs to change, actually.
In terms of the protest, like, did you get to see Sean Fraser or?
He called us, his office called us. That's for now, unfortunately, the news that I have. I don't have all the details, but he called us. Obviously, for us, it's not just a call. And what I haven't mentioned until now is that the budget, the federal budget, is coming. It's April 16, and we hope to see the government to change its track in that budget and to actually go towards financing social housing truly. There is time for us. It's coming in April, and there's still possibility that for the federal government to make this adjustment. That's what we hope seeing, and not just receiving a phone call from that protest.
Spring into Action, Outrage, is happening March 11th through 24th. Spring into Action is an annual event series that is organized and funded by QPerg McGill and SSMU. Every spring, QPerg organizes a week of free workshops, discussions, film screenings, and social events engaging local and global issues. We have an exciting lineup of events, including a screen printing workshop, community dinner and zine making night, Prison Abolition 101, and other practical and capacity building workshops for organizing in the midst of injustice and anger. Check out the schedule of events at qpergmcgill.org or on our Instagram at qpergmcgill.
All right, and we are back live in studio. You're listening to CKUT, broadcast at 90.3 FM, and this is our big funding drive week. I've got some News Collective volunteers with me in the house. You guys want to say hey?
Hello.
Hi.
And actually, we've got a little live stream going. You can head to cqut.ca if you want to get in on that action. But today, you know, it's just one of the many funding drive days we've got in the station. So if you want to donate, unfortunately, our page is having a couple difficulties online, but you can head to cqut.ca/donate. And just take a look at all the amazing swag from local artists in support of the station that you can get when you do make a donation. You can also call in at 514-907-9424. And you can also mail in to the station. Our address is Radio CKUT, 3647 University, Montreal, H3A2B3. Gonna hit you with a couple more ads, and then we'll be back live on air, so don't go anywhere.
CKUT's annual funding drive is back and taking place from March 15th to 24th, 2024. We have exciting new merch available for our donors, including t-shirts, tote bags, mugs, magnets, and posters. Thanks to the generosity of this year's sponsors, you'll get a chance to win goodies from your favorite local businesses, festivals, and more, with every donation $35 or above. This year's sponsors include Pop Montreal, Cinema Public, Constellation Records, Mutech, Festival du Nouveau Cinéma, Encore Books and Vinyl, RIDM, CNL Cycle, Adam Hart, Just Seeds, Lola Rosa, Putting Edge, Drawn and Quarterly, Death of Vinyl, La Rama, La Seltzer, Dispensaire Microbrasserie, Lou Guillaume, Pizza Bouquet, and Paragraph Bookstore. CKUT would like to thank our sponsors for supporting another year of people-powered community radio. For more details on prizes and to donate, go to cqut.ca/donate.
All right, and you are back listening to CKUT and one of our Funding Drive special episodes of the Local Journalism Initiative Roundup. I'm your host, Jules Bujel, and I'm going to be playing a little story cooked up by Sequoia Kim, who's with our News Collective. Last Wednesday, Sequoia went to a protest against the government of Quebec's out-of-province tuition hikes as part of an ongoing week of strike actions from Concordia and McGill students. They're like, let's be real, mostly Concordia students. And Sequoia talked to some of the folks there about why these tuition hikes are not just going to affect future students, but people at Anglophone universities right here, right now. Take a listen.
When education is under attack, what do we do?
What you're hearing is the sound of hundreds of McGill and Concordia students and other community members taking to the streets March 13th to protest the tuition hikes announced by the government. In October, the government announced that tuition hikes would double for out-of-province students, going from around 9,000 to 17,000, but they later backtracked on this, announcing that Bishop's University would be exempt and that the tuition fees would be set at around 12,000 instead, representing a 33% increase. This protest is coming amid a week-long strike called by student associations at McGill and Concordia last week, a coalition that included over 22,000 students at Concordia and over 2,000 at McGill.
This is the
This week-long strike is the third strike action that's occurred since the tuition hikes were announced. The first strike, at the end of November, saw around 1,000 students at Concordia go on a one-day strike. The second strike happened at the beginning of February, with around 12,000 students at McGill and Concordia taking part in a three-day strike. And that brings us to today's strike, which, just a month and a half later, saw the number of students on strike nearly double, at 22,000. During the protest, I spoke to some of the participants to ask them why they were there. For Chloe, a student at Concordia, the strike this week represents a strategic, political, and economic move.
I think that we can see this increase in tuition as an expression of an austerity politic, and when the defunding of our public education is linked to so many other struggles off campus, we are here in solidarity with the workers, we are here in solidarity with the Front Commune who is on strike in the fall, we are here building our power as students to fight back against these politics that are attacking our right to education.
And are you seeing any of the impact of these strikes in your life right now at all?
We're already seeing that courses are being cut. The departments have been told to slash their budget, and that means cutting courses. This impacts our ability to learn what we signed up to learn and our ability to access education even as current students.
Yeah, and then I guess, so what are your thoughts about the kind of strategic reason behind striking? Why is this an effective method of protest?
There's a couple reasons. We know that the Quebec government subsidizes our education, which means they have a vested economic interest in our completing the semester. When we are building the strike movement, we are threatening a general unlimited strike. We are threatening to withhold our academic labor and our participation in the system. This is a real financial, economic, and political threat to the government. It's also an opportunity for us to build our student power and to come together and to organize. It's the only tactic that has worked in the past. We can look at 2012, 2005, 1986, and we can see the success of student strikes.
And just to be clear here, Chloe is referring to the fact that universities in Quebec are state-funded and that tuition is fixed by law. So universities can't choose to raise or lower tuition outside of, institutional or registration or administration fees. Quebec subsidizes tuition to the tune of around $11,000 per student annually, a very heavy subsidy. And so, if an indefinite or unlimited strike were to be called, and that's a strike that goes on until certain demands are met, the government would stand to lose all that money. That's what happened in 2012. The students called an indefinite strike, protesting a 75% increase in tuition, and that strike lasted for more than 6 months. I also spoke to Amanda Gutierrez, a fourth-year PhD student at Concordia. For Gutierrez, the tuition hikes threaten more than just financial accessibility to education. They threaten to tear at the social fabric of Quebec and Montreal at large.
Why are you here today? Why specifically did you feel it was important to show up at this protest?
I think it's important because as a PhD student, in the 4 year, I might not be affected directly, but I think it's going to be deeply affected, not only for Montreal itself as a city, but also for the educational system. So once you cut off drastically in the way of how Quebec is sending this mandate, it means that it's a huge loss for education that is accessible for working class students and also for students of color. Indigenous, Black, and students of color who are also immigrants. And that means a huge cut as well for the diversity and implying also studies that might not be, directly connected to science or economy, but as arts and arts and education, cultural realms that are going to be extremely affected. And that goes to the diversity of voices and expressions that Montreal might have. Yeah.
So, I mean, why is that kind of diverse that you mentioned? Why is that important to you as a student here?
I think it's important to keep the diversity of voices, because otherwise it's just going to be super homogeneous. Only rich students with certain privileges are going to have access to the educational system that must be open and must be also not only accessible but reachable. Yeah. And once you cut the diversity of voices, it's just going to have a direct, you know, expression of what it means to fight, what it means to be present in the city, what it means to be also visible. What are the voices that are going to be visible and educated? And that's extremely important, you know, for the future of education.
Now, after the crowd heard some of the speeches, something that you don't see very often happened. The organizers invited anyone from the crowd to come up to the mic and share their thoughts. Have a listen.
Hey, what's up, guys? I'm not from Quebec. I'm gonna admit I'm French, okay? No, hey, whatever. We French people have a lot of rights concerning our education. How do you think we got it? Meetings? Sitting in closed doors? How do you think we got it? We went in the street and he fucking rioted, okay? So what is it up to the French people doing, okay?
This is super short. I'm from the United States. I've seen what greed does to education. It is nearly goddamn impossible to get a decent secondary level education there, to get a higher education, much less to enter the job market with that. It's fucking bullshit, and if you can stop it in this country, you should do every goddamn thing possible to do so.
I'd like to call out one specific person that's been central to the 2012 movement and are now completely muted about what's happening right now. Gabrielle Nadeau-Dubois, say something. Be present. Where are you? We can't see you. Show up.
On February 23rd, McGill and Concordia independently filed lawsuits against the government's tuition hikes, citing government overreach, discrimination against Anglophones, lack of proper consultation, and the fact that the tuition hikes created unconstitutional barriers to provincial trade by limiting student mobility, choice of university, and access to education. The student-led movement against tuition hikes is ongoing, and we have yet to see what the next actions will be. This is Sequoia Kim, reporting for CKUT 90.3 FM. Thank you for listening.
If it sounds like Montreal, it sounds like CKUT. CKUT's annual funding drive is back, and this year we're celebrating the city that made us. From Friday, March 15th to Sunday, March 24th, tune in for an earful of Montreal-made magic. Your favorite programmers will be live in studio and live streaming online for the first time ever. Tune in online, on the good old-fashioned radio, or join us in person. CKUT friends and family will be providing the tunes for an opening party at Bar La Marche à Côté on March 14th and a closing night on March 23rd at Nouvel Établissement. Stay tuned at our website for other events that put the fun in fundraising. Don't miss these celebrations of community radio and sounds of the city from your favorite local DJs. We need $50,000 to keep CKUT on the map. Powering a nonprofit radio station is more expensive than ever. Will you answer the call of your community before it's too late? Donate now by visiting ckut.ca/donate or by calling 514-907-9424. CKUT 90.3 FM, the sound of Montreal since 1987.
All right, and we are back live in studio. You thought the hour was over, the show was over, but you're wrong. We've got our amazing news collective team here to extend the local news roundup for an extra hour for Funding Drive. We've got Evelyn, who's going to be reviving Unfit to Print, a classic McGill Daily News show, as well as News Collective veteran Sequoia Kim. And they're joining me for the next hour. And we're starting things off with an interview about something that anyone who's at McGill currently will definitely want to hear about. In the midst of negotiating their collective agreement about 1,600 McGill teaching assistants have just voted 87% in favor of an 8-week strike bank, with a record turnout that could affect the end of the university semester. Now, their union, AgSem, is demanding a substantial pay raise with a cost of living adjustment, as well as healthcare and contracts indexed to student ratios. Today, I'm joined by Fanny Tissendi. Yeah, thank you. Fanny Tissendi, a first-year PhD student and TA in anthropology. Fanny, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I'm just going to adjust your mic a little bit. Give me a second. All right, let's try that again. Thanks for coming on, Fanny.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So McGill TAs now have this strike bank, this strike mandate. Are you guys actually going on strike? Like, when and how is that going to be decided?
So the decision to actually go on strike will be made by the bargaining committee. The bargaining committee is three people who, some of them formerly worked at STAs, some of them currently work at STAs, who basically represent us, represent the union in negotiations with McGill. And so the strike vote has given the bargaining committee the authority to declare a strike at any moment that they consider strategic for TAs in negotiations. And that moment will basically be determined by the process of negotiations and, you know, when the bargaining committee feels that we have reached a moment that we cannot make any more progress without going on strike.
Yeah, how likely is it if we're, like, being realistic here, from what you're hearing from the TAs, like, is it kind of a done deal that there's going to be a strike this semester?
It's definitely not a done deal. The bargaining committee either has wrapped up or is wrapping up a negotiations session with McGill as we speak. So it's definitely still possible for McGill to avert a strike by proposing a contract to TAs that goes in the direction of our bargaining mandate, which has not been the case so far.
Yeah, I'd like to hear about what specifically TAs at McGill are demanding and, like, just in general, why you've reached this point, what the situation is that's, you know, led you to say, okay, we might actually have to strike to get what we think we deserve in this case.
Mm-hmm. So a bargaining mandate, as you mentioned a bit in your introduction, asks for a substantial raise for TAs that places McGill in a similar pool as other universities of the U15, the group of Canadian research major